Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, my Get It Right with Dr. Bowles listener. I am so excited to share this show with you today. I do have my guest that has become rather familiar, hopefully, to you, Cassandra Bell Gash. She will be joining me in today's discussion of Black America Decaying from Within. But I would be remiss if I overlooked what is currently headline news. For those of you who may not have a chance to look at your computer, check your phones, or been on TV, there has been another horrible shooting here in the United States. This time it's on the very west coast of Oregon, and it seems that a young man, they haven't given out any names, opened fire at a small college, killed 13 and has wounded 20. Don't know any more details. I saw it as a news flash because I get a news feed, and I am just really, really, really saddened to think what it would be to have a parent have their child go off to a college campus and be in class when such a tragedy should strike. There's just no way to have prevented or thought about, and my heart certainly goes out to them. And I wanted to make you aware this is what's going on in these current events. Back on topic, however, we have been talking for the last few weeks about social justice in the United States, and I thought that I've been focusing or turning the spotlight outward, saying here's what's happening to Black Americans, and I wanted to step back because I can also speak from the perspective of what's going on within Black America. And with that thinking, I came up with the topic, Black America Decaying from Within. If you had a chance to read my marquee, you'll get the impression of what it is that Cassandra and I will be talking about today. What I've mentioned to you is there is a problem, in my opinion, which is a term of entitlement. Now, entitlement can mean a lot of things. We think, when I first heard the word, I think of Paris Hilton and the trust fund babies and all the very rich. But I think that I would be remiss if I did not also say that I see an act of entitlement in a most foolish way. And what I mean by most foolish way, I see young people, I'll say the millennium, as it's referred to, Generation Y, children born from 1980 until now, who have become very comfortable in a social strata where the U.S. government feeds them, provides housing for them, and gives them medical care for a nominal fee to the point of it being free. And this, to me, I learned firsthand, and I've been in the arena long enough, I've seen glimpses of it and would shade my eyes. I don't want this to be true. I don't want to acknowledge this possibility. And to be honest and frank and direct and continue what I hope these series have begun of what's going on in these United States with respect to Black America, I have to acknowledge, admit, accept that there are groups who are entitled. Now, I'm not entitled like Paris Hilton to all the riches of the world, but actually finding the niche of what I call bottom feeders, that it's okay to live in a Section 8 or government housing. It's okay not to work and receive food stamps at some pre-prorated amount. It's okay not to have a job, and so forth and so on. And with this, I am introducing the thinking, and those of you listening who'd love to call in, I invite you to. I'd love to have a major conversation about this topic and get your views. And until someone else should join me, I am very happy to share this show with Cassandra. How are you this afternoon?
Doing well, Dr. Bowles. Thank you.
So what do you think about this topic?
I was sitting here, and I always like to take notes when you're talking. It's very informative. And first of all, my heart goes out to the families involved in the incident today. We'll keep them in prayer. Moving forward to your topic for today, I took note for in looking at entitlement as a set of expectations, and it made me do a quick reflection back to when I was growing up. There was an expectation that my dad, James Bell, said that I would not bring home anything below a B. that I was going to do my homework as soon as I got home from school, that I was going to clean my room, and that I was going to call him if I was going to be late on my curfew as I began to be a teenager and able to drive, and so forth and so on. There was an expectation for excellence. There was an expectation to be compliant. There was an expectation that I was going to do certain things. There was an expectation that I was going to college. And because he set that expectation, nothing else was up for discussion. So when you look at entitlement and even some of the families that I work with right now, you see generations where the mother lives in the government assistant housing authority program, housing complex, and the daughter. And then they have a rising daughter who is pregnant. And that's their expectation, waiting to get on the waiting list so that they can get themselves government assistant housing. The government assistant apartment. And so I look and I say, where does the expectation change? Who does that for these generations of people who grow up on the system? And whether or not it's a family member, a mentor, I believe in mentorship, mentor programs, a case manager, a very concerned social worker. But unless the expectation is set, I believe we're just going to see people live out certain patterns, the same patterns.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because I had a conversation with a person I think is very knowledgeable, becoming a fast friend. I've only met him over the last 3 years. We met through radio broadcast, and he and I were sharing what is so different now that used to be. And the first thing sprang to my mind is, particularly in the Black community where I grew up, there was something I referred to as apprenticeship. That when I was young, I watched my mother make the bed. Now you say, well, what's the big deal? I was little. I was probably 4 or 5, and I'd watch her take that sheet, and she'd pop it into the air, and that sheet would settle on that mattress in such a way, so perfect. And at that young age where you're looking for things to emulate and people to be just like, that is something I marveled. And I would imagine when I would be able to do that bed like that. I wanted to pop that sheet and let it settle. And it occurred to me when I was talking to him, are we not modeling for our children anymore? Think about this, Cassandra. You're saying your dad had standards, and my dad certainly did. It saved me many a time with a groping young man to say, you know who my daddy is, and that would make him sit up, clear his throat, and act right, because my dad had quite a reputation for defending what was his. But we don't seem, I'm going to say this in a hypothetical because I don't live in a lot of households, but from what I have visited and from the side of clinical, I haven't seen the modeling. I don't see the mothers having children present while they're cooking, or having little children watch them make the bed. I mean, I shared this with my mother during the month of August when I visited with her in North Carolina, and I've told many of my listeners she turned 93 August 5th, and I'm so proud of that, that when we were talking, and I'd say, Mom, how did you come up with the idea that on a rainy day you would have us quilt? Now, for those who are too young to know what that is, we would literally have a pair of scissors, and Mom would give us these little templates made out of cardboard, and we would get old shirts or old jeans, and we would cut squares or circles or whatever the template was, and later Mom would sew these pieces together on a sewing machine, and we would create a quilt. As I said, we were way below the poverty level. Dad worked 2 and 3 jobs to keep us afloat. But she had the organizational skill to get her children to sit in a single room. We didn't even have central heat. We had an open fireplace or a belly, as they say, pot-bellied stove that burnt wood and coal. And she'd have us organized doing a task in unison. Now, I now understand, didn't understand then, how important that was. We were performing a skill. She was coaching and organizing. we were completing a task, because cutting four sides on a rectangle is no big job, but it's a sense of achievement. Look what I did. I have a stack of squares. I have a stack of diamonds, or whatever it was. We had a short-term, goal-oriented, accomplishable task. And second to that, Cassandra, it was conversation. I remember my mother and dad had gone rabbit hunting because we ate small game because we didn't have money to buy food of certain caliber. She would say, "You have a really good father, and your dad's a hardworking man." And I remember these little moments of her giving him, as you feel like, an advertisement. She was reinforcing to us a respect for him. She was providing to us a model of him. You know, we didn't have a lot of time with Dad. He didn't do a lot of babysitting. He did babysit, but not a lot. But through her words, she was cementing this bond. And I reflect on those moments when it didn't have anything to do with money, didn't have anything to do with high education. It was just time spent reinforcing values. Core values, the concept of a strong father, a concept of us working together as a unit, the idea of making a quilt from all of our efforts. We were contributing. I really wonder if without the organization and the sense of contribution, aren't we just a lost people?
It kind of seems that way. You know, one of the things that stood out in your reflection was when you stated, while it was raining, that you would be able to cut out shapes based on items that would have been discarded to make the quilt. And I was thinking about preparation. And when there's not appropriate preparation for times beyond the moment that you're standing in, that's when people lose sight. And the fact that your mother was a lady of vision, that she understood that the time that she had in that moment with the rain was an opportunity for her to switch gears and prepare for another time. The problem is when people don't imagine or have the vision that there is another time in which they will stand and live in other than the moment that they're existing in. And I was thinking about ants, and I was sitting here Googling 10 fascinating facts about ants, and it just says that in many ways ants can outwit, outlast, and outplay humans. And I thought that was comical because we really need to start looking outside of ourselves for the answers and solutions to our problems that exist within us, and it's all about perception. And I think when you don't have the right perception about your existence, it causes problems, it causes negligence, and a place of lack. I really do, because you have to be forward-thinking and say, you know what, I need to prepare. I don't know where I heard the saying, but it stuck with me that people waste ordinary days, therefore they're not prepared for an extraordinary day. And that, give or take a few words in the actual quote, really stuck with me over life, that, okay, what do I do in the downtimes? Because it's in the downtimes that you make pivotal decisions for your future. And so when families aren't doing that, when they're, you know, I've been on government assistance myself after having a multimillion-dollar company, as I said in one of the broadcasts, I think the initial one that I had the opportunity to be in with you. And so it was during that time that, since I wasn't worried about basic life need for food, I read, I studied, I took classes, and ended up with two masters. So the question is, what do you do in the downtime?
Well, it's interesting to say that. Go ahead, I'm sorry. Unfortunately.
No, go ahead.
Well, if you notice in my talk about entitlement, and you use yourself for an example, and I applaud you for that, I referred to the government assistance as handout and hand up.
Mm-hmm.
There are some who can receive when they're down and out, and it's a hand up. All they're doing is bridging that gap. You right. were able to know what you could do, what you had achieved, and during this time when what you needed to have to survive to get to the other side of that chasm, you received it. Well, I think that's
right.
the whole intent. That is the focus. When we say support or subsidy, it should be a hand up. You know, if I called you and I said, look, I'm desperate. It's right now freezing here and I have no money to pay my light bill, but if you will advance me $200 and let me get through this, I will get my electricity back on. If you should give me that, I should be grateful. I should realize that what you have done is giving me a hand up. You are believing me for the ability to do what I'm promising. And this, you know, there's no shame in that. I don't have any problem whatsoever to help any person who's willing to help themselves. But here comes the rub. When hand up becomes hand out. When I was looking at what to put on the marquee, I saw this one little thing. If you saw the little film thing I put up with the words, it showed, it said, well, when she has four children, her income will double. And I saw that, and it reminded me of a conversation I saw among what I would say very entrepreneurial young women who happen to be plotting their income not based on their own prowess, you know, how well they could type, how well they could write, how well they could take care of someone, how well they could clean or cook. They were basing their income prowess on what the government allowed. And it really blew me away because they were conducting themselves in a very systematic way. They were planning, they were discussing, they were sharing information, they were providing dates and person how, you know, get this counselor, make sure you have this person so that when you call her, you'll have her as a backup. I was just floored at the skills being displayed to ensure their income. Now, like the comment, if you have four kids, you can double your welfare money, as they call it, than if you have two children and so forth. If a hand up is truly a hand up, I applaud government assistance. But
right.
if a hand up becomes a hand out, now we are in a decay of anyone who begins to see the funding as their sole source, and worse, to see the funding as a targeted source. To have a young child or a young woman say, when I get to be this age, I'm going to have my baby, and then I'll get my house or get my Section 8 and get my welfare check. That's what chilled me.
Right.
And this is really the group I'm talking about. I mean, I know that the programs, when implemented, its intent was hand up. Let me pull you out of that hole. Let me usher you out of that darkness. That was the intent. But if I don't pretend and if I don't blink, I do know without question that there are those totally satisfied to be in that arena of receiving without effort. And that's what frightens me. It really does. When I was talking to Brother Lee, go ahead.
I was going to say, in my neck of the woods, I think that the bar is being raised. I'm seeing governmental agencies put more expectations on the recipients of benefits. I think that's a good thing. One of the things that I do know about Section 8 is it is exclusively for the primary caregiver and the children. Their significant others cannot stay there. If they stay there, they run the risk of losing their Section 8 and losing it for an extended period of time. And I think these controls help reduce the level of comfort that folks were initially seeking when they say, let me have multiple children, I'm going to live off of the system. I think living off of the system isn't as easy today as it used to be, and I think that's a good thing. I really think it's a good thing.
Well, that's interesting because I would, if I were standing beside you, cross that line and say, I think that's horrible. Let me explain myself. I happen to know a community where they spend great amount of energy making sure that the powers who impose that cannot enforce it. The reason I find that to be objectionable is that it mandates, in my opinion, that the household is run by a woman. It mandates, in my opinion, that a man can never be a mentor to his son. Because if for me to receive money, I can't have my significant other, and if that's the man who I'm making children with, then I am by design making him a fugitive. He comes in, he can eat with me, he can sleep with me, but he better get out before the authorities come. So if there is a male child in that house, what that male child is seeing is the man has no place, that the man has no authority, that the man can't bring money, and the man is a bad thing, because if the man's in the house, we don't get any money. And if the man's in the house, we can't this or that. Now, why do I say this with such vehemence? I think I may have shared this story with you, Cassandra. I was mentoring a young woman with two children, beautiful children, that were 4 years apart. She really did think through why she was having children and so forth. And when the older child was about six, the little boy was around 2.5 or so, she had a friend over and she was playing and they were doing house. They were making coffee and they were having me sip tea with them and they were doing their make-believe sandwiches, and a little boy came, and he wanted to play, and she kept saying, go away, no, go away, and finally, he said, I want to play. She said, you can't play, and he kept insisting. Finally, she looked at me and said, Dr. Bowles, what does a daddy do? And I was shocked. At that moment, I said, she is absolutely not being funny. She had no way to include her brother. She did not know how to play house with her brother present. Her mother was head of household, and her grandmother was head of household, and if a man came, he came and went. No one spent the night. No one brought groceries in. No one took them on vacation. No one did anything but show up and leave. And she looked at me in all seriousness and said, Dr. Bowles, what does a daddy do? And this is why when I wrote it that the government assistance program as it exists in some black Americans' lives rendered them back into a slavery-like mentality. They have to have permission. What grown adult, grown mature adult should have permission as to who stays in their house? If I want someone to stay in my house, I decide. But if you're in a Section 8, you are not an adult. You must ask permission. You must sneak. You must hide. You must pretend because the authority over that house is not you.
Exactly.
And this is one of my greatest.
You know, I was raised in one of them days where it didn't matter how old you were. It mattered if you were paying the bills. You know, I was raised in one of those eras where it was my dad's house.
Yes.
And I can remember the day I moved out.
Yes. Well, my dad would have struck that in a heartbeat. This is my house.
And I do understand. I understand what you're saying. And I don't believe that change happens until people become uncomfortable. And if assistance make it too comfortable, I don't believe that we can facilitate change. I do respect
that. Now you're hitting that nail on the head that I was thinking about. What will it take for us to take our dignity back? What do we have to do? And I say we, I'm including myself. I mean, okay, if you go to school and you get a degree, what you've already demonstrated is a desire of improvement. But if you drop out of school at 10th grade, 11th grade, or you don't get your diploma, and you anticipate, well, when I get pregnant, I will have somewhere to live, and I'll get WIC, I'll have something to feed my baby, and I'll get housing authority, because that's what they do. How do you change that? Because as long as that is in place, and there are people who can think in those terms, there's no reason to change.
I believe in mentorship. You know, it is unfortunate that there are young girls that I know that went to college and only lasted 1 year. And they didn't come out because they were pregnant. They came out because there was family needs back home that they wanted to financially assist. They came out because there wasn't anyone to send them that weekly $20, $30, $40, whatever it takes nowadays. It was $20, $30 many years ago when I was in college. I'm sure it takes more than that now. And so when I say mentorship, you know, just those who have, being able to set aside a little something for those who don't have, who are really trying to make it. And I think that's a personal plight that you have to look at and look and see, is there a child in my church? Is there a young girl in my neighborhood? Is there a young boy in my community? You know, what can I do? Each person needs to take a look around them and say, is there someone, a family, that I can invest in to give something back? Because
I say hallelujah to that.
The need is there.
I hear that and I get chills.
And it doesn't take a lot. It really don't take a lot. Even if you have a computer, it's small task. If you have a computer and you know how to do a resume, you know, then do a resume for a young mother who maybe don't even know how to apply for a job, or that they don't have a computer and they're uncomfortable with using a computer, so they're intimidated to even apply for a job online. There's a lot of reasons, I believe, why people don't change, and I think it is because of lack of knowledge and lack of information and being ashamed.
I, like you, was very optimistic. I'm not saying I'm not optimistic, and I now have thought of what our next topic is, because I don't want to go into this in detail, but I'm going to throw this out soon in our last 5 minutes, believe it or not. Two things I learned in my efforts to mentor. And the first one, I used to throw myself into it. I wanted things so badly for others. I do 99% of the work and present it and just, oh, like the puppy dog is happy to see you when you come home. I'm wagging. I'm excited. I'm just cheering. And I had someone to look at me and say, don't you know, Dr. Bowles, that you have to want to do it, or you have to want it? And I was shocked. I never thought that if I gave you this much opportunity that anyone would turn it down. I thought the reason most people or many people didn't achieve, as you're stating, was because of lack of opportunity, lack of funding, lack of something. And if I just filled in that gap, if I didn't let them lack, then they would perform. Well, I'm going to tell you, Cassandra, that's not 100%. I have absolutely been told under more than one circumstance that I can close all the gaps that I see, but if the person I'm dealing with does not have that dream, and that's something I talked to Brother Leroy this morning about, without dreams, you cannot have hope. So those who are comfortable and status quo, and the term I use is bottom feeders, they like being where they are. They're comfortable. If you go to school, you got to do homework. If you get a job, you got to get up and groom yourself. I even had somebody say, you mean every day I got to get up and do this? And I'm saying, well, yeah. This is what adult life is. You get up, you wash your face, you brush your teeth, you get dressed, and you go in while it's raining. That's right. You get an umbrella. But their whole expectation of how to earn what you and I take for granted as this is what I'm supposed to do, they were seeing it as a hardship. Why would I get up and groom myself and catch a bus in the cold weather to go and type or hit a cash register when I can lay in bed and get a check? What's my motivation? You know, if I like what I'm doing, if I enjoy my sleeping to noon every day, and, okay, so I have food stamps, but it's like a charge card. I'm not embarrassed. If I don't mind sneaking my boyfriend in and out, why should I want to change? And this is really the assembly that I'm addressing. I know that there are those who get the hand up, take it, and move forward. But on a positive note, from what you were saying, I think that the listeners should consider high schools now do combination community college and high school credits. And if you have a very ambitious young person who does not have much money, churches, schools encourage those ambitious young people to do the dual enrollments. And this will save money. They won't have the big tuitions, and they won't have the big student fees. And by the time they graduate high school, they could, in fact, have a technical degree. I mean, you can get a certain 18-month, 9-month type degrees from our technical colleges. So that would be my positive for those who are reaching out and can't quite reach that limb that's out of reach. Well, Cassandra, we're out of time. And as usual, whenever I get in conversation topics, I get excited. What would be your closing remarks for the Black America decaying from within?
I would suggest seeking wisdom, because where there's wisdom, there's anticipation. And where there's anticipation, there is hope. Education
Absolutely.
Is power. Knowledge is power.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining me today, and I thank you, my listeners, for joining us. And until next time, take care.